Now, if you had a choice between a guaranteed reward or taking a risk, which one are you going to go for? Well, most people would choose the guaranteed reward. We all like to play safe. But what about our closest relatives, the great apes? Well, Sarah Heilbronner is a researcher at Duke University in the US, and she's been giving chimps and bonobos, who are an animal related to chimpanzees, a choice between taking a safe bet and being more adventurous. So hello, Sarah.
Hello.
So what did you do in your experiments? What did you find?
Right, so we were interested in the evolution of decision-making strategies, and particularly decisions about risk. And as you said, we look to our closest evolutionary relatives, chimpanzees and bonobos, for help. So the task that we used has a very intuitive human analog, and so I'll describe that first. If I put you on a game show and gave you a choice between what's behind door number one and what's behind door number two, and said that you could keep whatever was behind the door that you chose, and also told you that behind door number one, there was definitely $40 or 40 pounds, such as it would be.
It's a bit of a low-budget game show, then.
Well, I never said it was going to be a very exciting game show, but, you know, you got on it for free, so it should be okay.
And door number two?
Door number two, there's a 50% chance that you'll get $10, and there's a 50% chance that you'll get $70. So the expected value of door number two is the same as the expected value of door number one. And as you suggested in your introduction, because you're a human, you're going to prefer door number one. You're going to prefer the safe bet to the gamble.
Do we know why people tend to be safe bettors, Sarah? Do we have a clue as to why we tend to play safe? Why don't we be more adventurous in our betting?
So this was exactly the type of question we were interested in asking. But instead of asking it about humans, we asked it about chimpanzees and bonobos, these great apes. But, of course, chimpanzees and bonobos don't regularly work with money, nor do they open doors. So we had instead a task where they were choosing between what's underneath bowl number one and what's underneath bowl number two. And we used grapes instead of money. So bowl one always covered four grapes. Bowl two, 50% of the time, covered one grape, and 50% of the time covered seven grapes. And what we found was pretty surprising. So chimpanzees, who are our closest relatives, they actually preferred the gamble. They didn't show the same types of preferences as humans. But bonobos were actually very much like humans, and they wanted the safe bet as opposed to the gamble.
So the chimpanzees were always being very adventurous. They were taking the high adrenaline option and gambling, even though sometimes they got much less fruit than if they'd picked the bowl that they knew had just four pieces of fruit under it.
Exactly. Now, over time, chimpanzees and bonobos obviously got the same amount of fruit because they were doing these choices over and over again, but they both had these strong but opposite preferences.
Have you any clue as to why, Sarah? Do you know why they were behaving like that?
Exactly. It's a big question. Why? So we went back and did some investigation into what they eat in the wild. Now, we were studying captive chimpanzees and bonobos in a zoo, but if these chimpanzees and bonobos had been in the wild, the chimpanzees would have been facing much more uncertain, much riskier food sources than bonobos. And I'll give you a couple of examples. One is that both of them feed on fruit trees, but the fruit trees that bonobos are feeding on are much more consistent in their environments, and they tend to be larger, so they're a much less risky option. Now, an easier one maybe to understand is that chimpanzees are sort of unique in that they hunt colobus monkeys. So they go out in these big patches, the big groups, and they search for colobus monkeys, and they invest a lot of time and energy into doing this. But if they manage to bring a colobus monkey down, they get a lot of calories. So it's sort of like a high payoff but high loss possibility there.
So what you're saying is because they have a high-risk lifestyle, then evolutionarily speaking, they've grown up to gamble, which is why they do it even when you put them in an experiment.
This is exactly right. So even when they're in an experimental situation and all the conditions are the same, they're still going to maintain the types of preferences that they had back in their evolutionary history.
So coming back to us, humans, for a second, what are the implications for the fact that we are gambling on the stock exchange, we go to the betting, we bet on the boat race? Cambridge lost, unfortunately, this time. It's bad news for us. But are we therefore applying the kind of logic that would have guaranteed in our ancestry that we would have filled up the fridge to a modern economy, and therefore there's a flaw in how we process our decisions?
It's a hugely interesting question because, of course, much of behavioral economics over the past few decades has shown that humans are not rational actors, even though we like to think of ourselves as extremely rational and reasoned about our decisions, especially when we're making big decisions about money. But these types of results do suggest that actually we're making decisions at least partially based on what was good for us during our evolutionary history. And the most important thing was then was not money, because money is a relatively recent invention. The most important thing was food. So these types of results suggest that even for us, even for, you know, humans, the rational actor, the homo economicus, even for us, we're probably making decisions based on strategies that we used in our evolutionary past to get food, and that we might not even be aware of now.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Sarah, for explaining that to us. So basically, put simply, next time you choose a safe bet over a risk, you're probably behaving more like a bonobo than a chimp. That was Sarah Heilbronner from Duke University. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
We've got Kitchen Science coming up in a minute, but before we go there, I have to mention this email we got from Mark in Melbourne, because he's obviously caught the spirit of Kitchen Science. What he wanted to do was measure how fast his sonic toothbrush actually brushes. So he used a sound recorder to measure the sound it makes, and then he looked at the waveform, which your computer can show up, to see how many oscillations per second. Now, he counted 25 per tenth of a second, which is only 15,000 cycles per minute. But they claim on the packaging that it's 30,000. Now, I'm not really sure. I don't know if this is the best way to measure it. If anybody knows, and do feel free to get in touch. Chris, what do you think?
I think you might be onto something, because when I was driving around in Australia last year, a group of schoolchildren decided to measure vitamin C in foodstuffs as their school science project. And they took an off-the-shelf substance, food, or I should say a drink, Cordial, which is well known, very, very powerful brand, which said full of vitamin C. And they thought, well, we'll use that as the control, because we know that will have lots of vitamin C. And if we can detect that, we know our experiment's working. And they kept getting a negative result. And it turned out that the company were lying and saying it's full of vitamin C and there was none in it. And they had to actually pay a very big fine and then change all their labelling. So it could be that in this particular sonic toothbrush, there's a little bit of adventurous advertising going on. I think if anyone else has a sonic toothbrush and they would like to record it, analyse the waveform, or if in fact you've done this, please do the experiment and then tell us how many cycles a second is it producing. Is there some misleading advertising going on here?
It would be really fascinating to find out. And it is great. We're really pleased, Mark, that you're getting into kitchen science in this sort of way.
Thanks, Ben. Well, still to come on The Naked Scientist, of course, we are talking about microbes this week, and we'll be talking shortly to Sarah Staniland, who is a researcher at Edinburgh University and has discovered some of the micromagnets that bacteria make inside their cells. Why should bacteria make magnets? And moreover, what do these magnets do to the bacteria that when they make them? And how could we exploit that technology for bettering human health or staving off human disease? If you want to join us on the programme, send in your questions, comments, thoughts, email chris@thenakedscientist.com.